You're listening to Always Record from SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com. Alan Abadesa Green and David Plate host this ongoing series of long-form roundtable conversations.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I feel like we haven't done a show just the two of us in a while. And I think, you know, it's good just for us to kind of touch base with each other, just for my own personal enjoyment, but also just, like, the guests have been awesome. We've had a run of really great shows, but I just kind of wanted to do something where just the two of us touch base.
What was the person's name? Campbell? Tom Campbell?
Yeah.
What's his deal? I was trying to look him up and I couldn't find.
Oh, you should be able to find a lot about him. He does search Tom Campbell, My Big Toe.
Okay, that came up. I didn't realize it was the same person.
Yeah. He's basically written like an encyclopedia. It's his theory of everything. T-O-E.
Okay.
And, it would be very easy for you to find a ton of interviews that he's done, and, I don't expect you to dive into his, like, three-volume set of big books, but you should be able to kind
okay.
of acquaint yourself with his theories
okay.
pretty quickly
pretty,
and interviews them.
Pretty extensive work.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't know. I don't know where to start today, really.
I think we could probably start with, just sort of where your videos have been going lately. Are these new discoveries? Are they things that you wanted to put out there for a while and are only able to do now because you have a newer computer, or what?
Yeah,
sort of,
there are things that I've wanted to do for a while, with a couple exceptions. One of them being Eye of the Devil, Sharon Tate's debut film, and Abbey Road, which I thought was just incredible. And the way that it ends, I couldn't have asked for anything, for it to happen to fall into place more ideally. And that was really exciting, because I kind of put that together, and then I was like, fuck, I can just make the video now, and I don't have to, you know, it was really a smooth process comparatively to what I was dealing with before. And so it might look that I'm just pumping out these videos, but most of them I've been wanting to do for quite a while.
I want to ask you a question. I think we've discussed this, but this is something Bill, you know, when Bill first contacted me, way before we even started Always Record or anything, he had contacted me that he was trying to get people to try out his Kubrick Transformer arrangement. And he was having a really hard time getting people to actually take the time to do it. And I did take the time to do it, on two different screens and set up the MP3s and all that sort of stuff. And, but I kept saying to him, you know, I think if you had an edited version that you could show people, you'd easily have a ton more eyes on it than you would if you were just asking people to make the arrangement. And his point was, there's something in the process of actually finding it, or doing it yourself, of getting the pieces and putting it together, that was, you know, part of the magic. And he really resisted the idea of making an edited version for a long time because of that. I'm just curious where you kind of stand on that, as a ideal concept versus, you know, what's, if you want to convey something, do you have to kind of, you know, is it some assembly required, or do you hand someone a?
Well, this is, there's nothing like doing it yourself, because just even quality wise, like, I can do something to the most optimal degree that I'm capable, and deliver it on the internet. But if you own a DVD or if you have a video file, in the getting your timing and letting it land for yourself, it's like, you know, it's like if you're DJing, you know, and things fall into place, there's something that's really exciting about that. And when it's your own hands that allowed it to do it, even if somebody told you the formula, there's a sense of magic in that that you just don't get from watching somebody else's video. But at the same time, it makes it accessible. My hope is that by putting them out there, that people will see the timing and where to start it and do it themselves for presentation purposes with friends and stuff. I mean, I on my blog, I've not wanted to change my page for the longest time just because I have an explanation for the timing to do it yourself, and then for a number of them, I have the videos right there so you can get the idea, you know. But there was somebody recently, I looked in my comments on my current page that's up. The guy, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. I could look it up, but he had the idea of doing that Wilco Foxtrot business with Eyes Wide Shut, which I feel kind of bad. I haven't seen it yet, considering that this person, the most complex one that I put up, he actually did, and really enjoyed it, which was E.T. and Poltergeist and Gremlins. And there's a particular timing to every facet, and playing them all with Mogwai's album Mr. Beast. And he did it. I was like, really? You played three videos at the same fucking time with the album, and he got all the pieces, and he arranged it, and he really enjoyed it. And just the fact that, like, even just, like, one person went... Because I was like, do I even want to put this up, almost? Because I don't think anybody will go to the trouble to do this. But it's so cool, you know? It's so enjoyable, the way everything is so complimentary. And, like, and you know my rationale for that is that they all came from the same story. Gremlins and E.T. and Poltergeist. What's it called? Watch the Skies or something? Or... And then
Night Sky? Yeah, something like that.
They changed it to Night Skies because Watch the Skies was taken, I think, is what happened. But anyways, like, just the fact that you're looking at aliens on one level and these spiritual entities on another, and then gremlins, which are very cliffotic in terms of them coming out of the shells and this whole thing. And so I look at it and I'm just like, I have my own way of relating to it. You know, I look at Steven Spielberg and I'm like, is he just like totally like some Hollywood Kabbalist who never, you know, is outright with it, but is just very, you know, subtle and clever and in a way that people don't generally expect because he's fallen into a certain category, you know, or people approach him through a particular lens because that's the lens that's the status quo lens of interpreting, you know, these guys like George Lucas and stuff. And I think that he's a lot deeper than people give him credit. And I honestly have to, you know, really acknowledge Horse Lover Fat's subliminal synchrosphere, because that was, I mean, I grew up just obsessed with Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, you know, but I had never... And then I got it so into occultism, but I'd never approached them through an occult lens until, I mean, I did to a degree, but I didn't really recognize like how deep it really goes with them. And that was like a huge inspiration, you know? So, yeah, I'm really, I'd be really excited to get that up somehow. I almost want to do like a kind of transparency overlay, similar to like... what John Fell Ryan did with The Shining. I also just want to play like Eyes Wide Shut forwards and backwards superimposed with itself. That's another video I've been wanting to put up because that's really cool. You know, I would love to go to a showing of that, The Shining forwards and backwards. I think that that's so innovative and neat, you know. It's really,
Sure, and I love
yeah.
that they've actually been doing, I mean, John's been doing them for a number of years, but with the success of Room 237, they've actually been able, they've done at least a few times, I think, where they've done a screening of Room 237 followed by or preceded by a screening of John Fell Ryan's Shining Forward and Back.
At some point, I want to do some synchronicity showings other than just out of my house. I mean, I've been, Joe Alexander's been coming over, somewhat regularly, and I've just been showing him video after video of what I've been working on, and it's been really cool. He just happens to be here with his basketball team, the Santa Cruz Warriors, and so that's really worked out. Yeah, I want to do like a whole presentation. I think that that's so neat that John Fell Ryan's been, able to do that. And I don't know. There's something about the magic that occurs in a group situation. It's just if somebody's watching a video on the internet by themselves, it's cool that they can do that. And I really like the presentation. The presentation is really a big part of it.
If I want you to sort of let this stew in your mind, but Andras and I have been really kicking around the idea of doing something this summer, some sort of event in the Pacific Northwest. We're thinking maybe doing like Olympia. It's between Portland and Seattle, where there's so many people in Portland and so many people in Seattle, and get like a bunch of us together and do something where, kind of like we did in the Bay Area. Could be one aspect of it, but to do something where we actually have screenings and stuff, I think would be so wonderful to kind of combine these different ideas where you could have the fun music element of Radio 8 Ball, you could have the film screening element, you could also have what we did in New York City was more of like a presentation style, people getting up and talking for 10 minutes. I mean, we kind of mixed it up even there. What we did there was, I think, Kevin Halcott showed a 10-minute version of his Thin Film Membrane, was his sort of, everyone got like 10 minutes. And Halcott showed his film, was one of the pieces. I showed like a 6-minute clip from Bill's Kubrick Transformer. So there were some film screenings, but sort of intermixed between other presentations, people getting up and doing a slideshow, PowerPoint presentation, or stuff like that. And then we also mixed in a Radio 8 Ball, and I kind of just tried to make it that it kept changing. It wasn't just one thing, it just kind of kept rotating through these different types of stuff. But I just see, like, if there was a way to really synthesize those, or just have, hey, it's on Friday night, we're going to do Radio 8 Ball on. Before the show or after the show, we're gonna do a screening of Rosemary's White Album, or whatever it is. To do something like that, where you could actually have the proper time to put together something and have a bunch of fucking people there. And I, even from an energetic level, I wonder, how much energy can you pack into a room?
Right.
These kind of minds. So yeah, I just sort of want you to think about that as like it's something we're really trying to start planning, and we're thinking probably August. And if it's something that you feel like you would want to take part in, maybe pick your best film or two that you would want to bring there, and we're gonna at least try, to get all this set up.
Well, I go to Seattle somewhat regularly because Amy has family there. The timing of it might be tricky because I'm going there already for holidays and stuff. Worst case scenario, you can show some of my work if I'm not able to make it. Because Olympia is still quite a ways from Seattle proper.
It's really long. It's like an hour and a half, yeah.
Is it? Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I love the idea of meeting up and doing presentation stuff. I'm really, really into that. And at the same time, I want to do showings here, where I mean, I have friends with projectors and stuff, and I could set up my art and do a whole deal, and I'd be cool to get other people involved in that as well. I'd say, we'll see how things unfold, but
Yeah, and I
I'm
feel like, by doing these different things, even just having the conversation about the videos, now obviously you've been able to make these videos available or a number of them available online on your Vimeo account. But I see that you're actually inspiring people. Like you said, you have a comment from this guy who's saying, "Hey, try this Eyes Wide Shut Wilco sync," and Patrick Sivek has really gotten into it, and he's trying these different pairings. And I know you had inspired Andras to try White House Matrix, and just all these different. To me, it's inspiring that it's inspiring. If that does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly feel that there's something going on, and it's beyond fishy, And I find it amazing that the more that I find, the more that I find. Like every time I'm more sure of myself in my I feel less insane the more I come out with something that I mean, some of them are just synchronistic. Like I'm attaching meaning to something because I'm able to do that, or I'm projecting meaning. But there's certain cases, like I just put up Valley of the Dolls with Marilyn Manson's Mechanical Animals, and like that's another example of something that I honestly don't see how he couldn't have intended for that. There's just too much there, and the timing of everything and everything that's being referred to is just so ridiculously applicable to his whole thing. Like that's like what he's into, so it makes perfect sense, like on every level. And so I can't help but feel like there's kind of like a secret society type thing going on, and that's pretty far out. But I don't see why. Like people ask me, why would an artist do that? And I'm like, why wouldn't an artist do that?
Hey, I want you to hold that thought because that's an interesting area. I just need to ask you, you're kind of breaking up on my end. Like every few words is kind of skipping out.
Okay. Well, you sound fine on my end, so
Okay, I was gonna say, and just as long as you're recording, we can see if your version is better. If at any point I start to cut out for you, let's just try stopping and calling back.
sure.
Yeah. So when you say a secret society thing going on, you mean like people who are kind of in on the joke, or if we want to call that a joke, what exactly is a joke?
Right.
But the idea of people who are saying, "Hey, there's something more here." I get what you mean. Like, you look at a Stanley Kubrick. People talk about, "Oh, Stanley Kubrick's encoding all this stuff." It's like, well, yeah, he is, and he's also, it seems he understands how to build architecture that synchronicity can play in, and it's like, I think of it like almost like someone recently, I think it was Scott Onsott, used the expression Easter eggs. You can look at history and geometry and geology and geography and all these different things, and you're finding Easter eggs. You're finding little hidden treasures. And it's sort of, we saw with the advent of DVDs, people burying little Easter eggs into the DVDs. I mean, it's the same concept, isn't it? It's just like
Totally.
before we had the technology for you to click on a scene or click on, a bookshelf in the middle of a scene, people were using film to bury different types of treasure.
Yeah.
It's fun. Like,
Totally.
why? Like you said, why would someone do that? Because it's fucking fun. Like, why? Yeah, why wouldn't you? It's
Right.
like, hey, I've got this. I'm building a landscape, and I can bury something on it.
So, recently I just I was looking at a thread of comments, and it just seemed like the obvious thing to do, that the single of or the, I guess you call it the EP, so not the whole LP of Magical Mystery Tour, you know, came out on December 8th, you know, John Lennon's death day, and all of this whole deal, you know, Feast of the Immaculate Conception, the same day and year that the Rolling Stones came out with Their Majesty's Satanic Request. And so, you know, I thought for a second about the film. You know, Patrick Sveck had mentioned that he'd seen it 25 times or something like that, you know, of Magical Mystery Tour. And so I was like, fucking play Rolling Stones over the Beatles film. And, like, that was an example of something where I honestly feel that the more rational explanation is that that's, after watching it and how incredible it was, that this is something that they apparently intended to do. That's my feeling around it. And so, like, that's the earliest one I've come across. So I was looking at, like, you know, Summer of 42 and Adam Hart Mother, and which is an absolutely incredible sync. If you haven't seen that one, I highly recommend it. It's totally mind-blowing. But that's 1970, maybe 71. This is like, I forget, I think it's 1967. And so I'm always interested, or I have been interested, in what's like the earliest example of something that I can find that isn't just like, doesn't feel just like a happenstance. Like, and I don't want to write something off as a happenstance, because that's exactly what we're interested in here simultaneously, is the nature of the universe and the way that things fall into place, and what a magical thing we exist within in the first place. And so, but then that extra push that brings it to the next level, that is the will, you know, where there's a will involved. And I found it really interesting that even at this time, you see these people are beginning to dabble in Thelema and occultism. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, their Majesty's Satanic Request is a drug album, very similar to Sgt. Pepper. It's a drug album, is what, you know, I think it was Paul, if I'm not mistaken, who was quoted as saying that about Sgt. Pepper. He's like, you know, this is a drug album. But it's like, you know, they got all these occult references.
Yeah, that so oversimplifies what that album is.
Oh, completely, yeah. And then you look
like that's a total, it's a one-off red herring in a sense.
Yeah, and so, I mean, just this morning, well, last night I started, and this morning it came through, was Kenneth Anger's, what is it, the Pleasure Dome, what is it called? I want to say Inauguration of Pleasure Dome, but that's not what it is. You know what I'm talking about. The one with Marjorie Cameron.
Sure, yeah. I don't know why I can't.
I'm spacing on it, really, even though I just fucking put the video up.
Brain not functioning.
But anyways, I play Sgt. Pepper over it, and I showed it to you when you visited.
Yeah, it's Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome.
Yes, okay. And so, you know, I noticed that there was three songs that are just about the same length. If you look on the Wikipedia page, it gives a slightly different timing for what my iTunes actually says by 1 second. But I think it's because it's within a second. It's not actually maybe like a full second, but whatever. Basically, there's three songs that are just about 2 minutes and 37 seconds long. And if you take any one of those songs out and you start it from the beginning of the Inauguration of the Pleasure Dome, then it'll end right as the film ends. And so I'm like, wow, this would be perfect if it wasn't for just one of these songs. But then I'm like, wait a minute, there's three fucking songs that are all the same length. And so I'll take one out, and then I'll put the rest back in its place. You know what I mean? Like, I'll move it all over. And then I was like, well, this is three different versions of the same sync. And then I'm listening to the end of it, and I'm like, you know, the Mighty Superman thing backwards, you know, and then forwards, it's Any Other Way. Could it be any other way, is essentially what they're saying. And so I looked at that, and I was just like, they're repeating over and over again, Any Other Way, at the end of the thing. Like, could you do it differently, and would it still work, is like the implication in what's being repeated. And so like that was it's really fascinating because if you then replay it with a different set of songs, it still goes in sync, you know, because it's a psychedelic experience, and the way that it's so loosely orchestrated, both the album and the film, I could not put all three versions up. And so right now I have all three. I have the video, and then I repeat the video, and then I repeat the video again with each different version of rearranging the songs of the album, by taking one out for each. And I'm really pleased with it. I feel good about it. I mean, I don't expect anyone without a psychedelic aid in most chances to watch all three in a row, you know. But I would encourage them to, because it's really neat if you're paying attention and you start to catch the different nuances that occur in the three different versions. It's really kind of exciting, at least for myself. So I don't know. I couldn't not put it up just because it was such a fascinating little deal. Plus, it's just Kenneth Anger, and out of the stuff that Kenneth Anger has done, that's probably my favorite. Oh,
This
yeah.
is kind of a just a tangent thought that just sprung to mind, and it's, you know, take it for what it is. It's just kind of a little flash of a seed of something that's not really fully formulated, but you just want, there's three different things, and you have room, and this idea of 2, 3, 7, which we already connect to the moon, right? Jay Widener points out, you know, the moon was thought to be 237,000 miles from the Earth, or whatever it is. We had Scott Onstott talking about the ratio of the Earth to the moon and how this connects to 2, 3, 7, and on all these sorts of things. With that in mind, so you have 2, 3, 7 is already a sort of lunar number. Then you're saying there's three different songs that hit that timing. So if using the same sort of weird psychedelic logic, take the three out, and what are you left with? But the 2, 7, right? The 27. 27 is a number that we've many times connected to the moon.
And the
It's
death
also,
of
you
John
have
Lennon.
the whole 27 club and all that sort of stuff. Like, there's so many things sort of embedded into this that would again speak to this idea of a moon child, right? Like, the Holy Trinity, the three different songs, you know, who is the moon child, you know? And again, is the moon child an actual entity, or is it a sort of, you know, again, a tulpa, some sort of, you know, mindset? I don't know. Again, it's like, it's not a fully formed idea. It was just when you were talking, that was what was popping into my head.
No, I've been having a lot of really strange ideas around that recently. Like, I've been connecting the Moonchild with death and sacrifice, as in that out of a sacrifice something is born, and if all the parameters are met in a particular way. Sounds kind of strange, but it's actually like that's fundamental to kind of an occult take on Christianity, being that out of the death, the resurrection, something else is born that's set, or at least something set into motion, and like a phoenix, you know, the phoenix dies and
Sure,
something
and
else
there's, I mean,
is.
there's even the sort of quasi-Christian idiom, God does not close one door but opens another. You know, it's an idea that carries over through most religious or spiritual or mystical traditions. Again, I feel like it's a sort of truism. It's just, at what point, how do you want to look at that or actually apply that? You know, you have so many people online talking about, oh, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman dies, and it's like, oh, it's an occult sacrifice to Lucifer, or, you know, I don't know. Every time a celebrity dies, you have this idea of it's an occult sacrifice to Lucifer or Satan or the Illuminati or whatever. And there could be something to that. You know, sure, I'm open to it, but again, it's like how the architecture is so right. It's so true on a symbolic level. I don't know if it carries over to the literal level.
Well, there's just all these weird pieces, you know, and following the life and death of John Lennon, you know, I've been really giving a lot of attention to like these weird things that I just seem like just completely meaningless jokes, but then when you really follow through with them, they start to make more and more sense. Oftentimes in a very psychedelic way, but all these people are on psychedelics and they don't even know. From what they've expressed, they don't even know what is going on because there's just so many things happening all at once, especially with the Beatles, you know. So like I look at like this kind of debate between Paul and John as to who is the walrus, as a really a debate about who is the carpenter. And which
Absolutely,
so
I totally get
like
that.
they're
Because the
fighting.
carpenter is the Jesus figure is going to be the sacrifice.
Right,
And
exactly.
Paul is dead. It's like, no, actually, Paul is not dead. John is.
And so, you know, you look at like John's fascination with the Passover plot when he was attacked for his statement on Beatles being bigger than Jesus. You know, his explanation was that he w was really drawn to this book that had a big impact on him. And you look at the what that book is about. It's the idea, it's putting forth the supposition that Jesus was aware of the ritual nature or the ritual necessity of his own death. And so he planned to be killed and go along with the program in order for something to come out of his death. And there's a prophecy, a Masonic prophecy, and so he takes the steps to aid in this happening. And it sounds weird, but there's all these examples with John where it's like it's not that much of a, I mean, it's he's saying that he's going to be assassinated. He said it in a couple interviews, I guess. And it's like that's not that far out. Like he's a revolutionary. Of course he thinks he's going to be assassinated. But then
Right,
it's
or he's playing up the martyr figure. Right.
yeah, but
You
then
know, the
there's
way things are going, they're going to crucify me. You know, at the end of Come Together, he says, "Shoot me, shoot me." Right? It's like it's almost calling on. This is again the Suicide King's sort of root here is that it's almost a suicidal tendency. I made this. It's I don't know if it's a joke in poor taste or not, but about Barack Obama. You know, there's this idea of suicide by cop. Are you familiar with that expression? Yeah, so like there's suicide by cop. I was saying I feel like Barack Obama's playing suicide by archetype. It's like you keep playing with this thing that's saying, hey, I'm a fucking martyr, hey, I'm a fucking martyr, hey, I'm a fucking martyr, I'm resonating with this, check me out, how much I resonate with this. And it's like, dude, do you realize where that leads? You know, like you do know that it at some point you like if you keep calling on it, you're only going to entrench yourself with it further. So I could totally see something along those lines where whether intentional or perhaps subconscious, where it's like, okay, assholes, yeah, you know, you're gonna give me a hard time about this. I'm gonna show you I am bigger than Jesus, or as you say, a revolutionary. I think it's so common, even in the conspiracy crowd, so many quote unquote revolutionaries who very quickly fall into the martyr role. Well, hey, listen, this is really important. It's more important than my own life, and this has gotta change. And hey, so what? I'm gonna die, and there's a small part of you. Your ego that plays into that and goes, yeah, fuck yeah, I'll be important. You know, I'm gonna do it for the cause, but I'm, in a way, even though you're killing your ego, it's an ego boost to think I will be remembered forever for doing this. So it's this really tricky psychology that I don't even think most people realize consciously. It's your ego playing with itself, you know, boosting itself when you don't intend for it to. It's almost like a drug, you know. So that I think is a really important sort of piece of this puzzle. Is it's in my mind very possible that what you're saying as a revolutionary, he could be starting to see himself as this martyr figure. All that being said, again, it's a much bigger puzzle than just that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's like it's not just him either. And there's so many weird, like, there's things that I can't get out of my mind. Like, watching Rosemary's Baby and seeing the four white beetles in front of the building, when that, girl dies, what's her name? I can't remember. Petria. See, I wish we had fucking Patrick Svek on this show, because everything that I can't remember, he'd just be like, oh, yeah. But, you know, you got this beetle covered in blood right in front of where he was killed, you know, number of years, let's see, 12 years before he dies. Okay, that's interesting in the first place, and just seeing that and where that lands when you play the White Album over it, and As My Guitar Gently Weaves kicks in right when the Crowley character walks up, you know, Crowley-modeled character, overtly. But then, you know, later on, when they're saying goodbye and Goodnight is playing, and they're saying goodbye to Crowley, and he's going leaving in the taxi cab, you know, there's this close up of the gate to the Dakota, and the traffic director is wearing this white glove, and he points, and it's a close up on his hand and his pointing finger, right to the spot where John Lennon's killed years later, and it's like, I just see that, and it looks like some fucking programming. Like, I can't help it. Like, I look at that shot, and I'm just like, it's like, go here. You know?
Have you considered, this is, again, just as wild or insane a theory as anything else, but, you know, John Lennon had talked about one of the main reasons he loved being in New York, and even as a non-celebrity, I really strongly sympathize with this mindset. It's one of the things I miss the most about New York, is the ability to be somewhat anonymous there, that, you know, even as a celebrity, the most that's going to happen is you're going to walk down the street and someone's going to go, oh, hey, John, and, you know, whatever, but that's it. For the most part, you can go about your day and shop in the store. I mean, the last time I was up in New York just to visit my mom, on the way, as we're leaving town, I stopped into a health food store, and, you know, Danny Glover's shopping in the supermarket, you know? It's things like this where it's like it's a non-issue. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is, here's a guy who almost wants to disappear from the limelight, right? His song "Watching the Wheels," it's basically like people say, "Don't you want to keep being famous and keep making art and all this sort of stuff?" And he's like, "No, I just kind of want to chill with my family and stuff." So again, this is just a theory I'm gonna just, you know, throw out there to add to the pile. But, you know, is it all these different things just as saying, telling you Paul is dead. Oh, actually it's John. You know, John is the walrus. No, John's the carpenter. All these sorts of things. Knowing this connection between Polanski and them, you have this pointing. Could it be, in a sense, a programming, not of a magical sacrificial ritual, which again is very, very possible, but also perhaps the idea of him faking his death, you know, so he could disappear. Just as the Paul is dead, quote-unquote, hoax, is the John is dead also a hoax?
I don't feel that it's a hoax. My feeling is that, you know, they recognize, you know, how big people become if they're, you know, I forget his name, but there was one of the big inspirations for the Beatles in the early days. There's this guy that did rock and roll music in Liverpool, who ended up, you know, being pretty big, but he's still fucking playing, and he's in his 80s. And like I said, I can't even remember the guy's name, you know, but he's, most people don't know who he is, yet he was the Beatles' inspiration, you know, but he didn't fucking die a crazy ritualistic death, you know. I don't know. I trip out on Mark David Chapman's whole deal with that he's identified with Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, and the Munchkins are telling him not to do it and all this stuff. And here you have NYOZ, you know, one letter removed, and that, you know, all these associations just playing into it. And it's just like, I just cannot believe I think it scares Amy a little bit when I start going there, and I just voice my process out loud, and she's like, it's kind of freaky that you're really looking into Charles Manson to the degree that you are. You know, I'm like that guy in, you know, Slums of Beverly Hills or something. I'm just like all into Helter Skelter all of a sudden. But I'm into it for synchronistic reasons, but it's kind of freaky at the same time because, you know, these guys are into it for apparently, I mean, that was Mark David Chapman's whole deal was that he couldn't get over the synchronicities. He was like, he's staying at this place, Rosemary's Baby. Like he's making these connections, you know?
Right. And with the Manson family, it's the same thing as them saying, hey, I think the Beatles are talking to us through their lyrics. They're telling us how things are going to play out, right? His whole idea of Helter Skelter and what that meant. Now, obviously, you could argue the more sort of mainstream argument could be that Manson is steering the interpretations towards his own agenda, right? It's like the mainstream sort of take on that. That Manson's saying, oh, you love the Beatles, but check it out, this song really means you should be killing for me, or
right, but then he's in the solar
and then there's
lodge,
the idea that,
so
again, yeah, like, taking a bunch of fucking psychedelics, listening to trippy music, realizing that the synchronicities are there, it can fuck with you.
Right.
And again, when we're talking about this whole idea of, you know, not even going to Manson and MKUltra, which again, you know, could only make him all the more unstable or all the more programmed. But when we talk about just the idea of people doing an experiment like this where these martyr impulses sort of come into play, you know, it's a lot of it is there are days where I'm surprised that it doesn't happen more, as fucked up as that sounds. It's the reason especially when you realize how close, you know, the Manson ideology comes to a lot of the contemporary, and you could say again he was borrowing from Eastern mysticism, he's borrowing from even Scientology or all these things. It's not like he wasn't aware of them, but whether or not it's him taking a synthesis of these things or coming to similar but slightly skewed versions of what we're talking about, that's scary to me, is to say, like, wait a second, if we're coming so close, you know, Doug, when I was saying this to Doug, he kind of got scared, and he's like, are you saying you're thinking like Manson? I'm like, no, I'm saying we need to be really cautious that if we're talking about these ideas, we're making a very clear distinction between how do you keep yourself grounded while exploring these sometimes dangerous headspaces.
Yeah, I mean, I know he belonged to the Solar Lodge of the OTO. I found that. I mean, I don't know how much he actually participated in all of that, but just the fact that he's on the list, you know, I mean, that's actually documented. And then apparently, you know, we had this conversation with this guy who was telling us, you know, that where do I go after Clear in relationship to Scientology?
Uh-huh.
Like, he's gone through all of that, and was like, wow, he's really immersed in all this stuff. I don't know. It's really something.
I want to take a slight turn here just to introduce another sort of piece of the puzzle. Will Morgan dropped something on Facebook earlier this week or last week that I had never heard of, and maybe as a big Pink Floyd fan, maybe you were already aware of it. The Division Bell's Publius Enigma.
Yeah,
are you familiar with
I think
that?
I found it. I think it's Children of a Lesser God. Film with what's his name? Hurt. It's a film about deaf people, and I think that's my feeling is that's what it was pointing to. I still have to put that video up, but I haven't been able to find the right file to give me the right timing to put it all together. But yeah,
I'm sorry. Can you backtrack on that? And
so there's a film called Children of a Lesser God.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically a school for deaf people, and it's another absolutely perfect, like, ridiculous sink. And I've been I found that probably when I was in high school.
Are you playing the Division Bell over this movie?
Yeah. But I feel it's as simple as that, that's what I remember when the Publius Enigma, came out, you know, and it was on this big billboard, or not billboard, but, what do you call it, where they have the lights and they have something written, you know. It was like during the concert, you know, this thing comes forward.
Yeah, and, they projected it on,
yeah,
on the stage.
It's been a while. I'd have to look it up again. But my at the time, following everything through, that's where it led me. And it was like a incredible synchronicity. And so that was my feeling, that it was just as simple as that. But if you get into it, and everything that's being communicated around it, it's that there's another level to it that's not just, oh, these two things go in sync, but it's what is revealed in that. It's pretty deep. But yeah, I would recommend anybody to try it. I mean, it's just I believe it's right when Paramount fades out at the beginning. You just, you know, take the Division Bell and play it with Children of Lesser God. It's really neat.
I just, for whatever it's worth, so I'll link to this Wikipedia page in the show notes. But I just want to read like a paragraph and a half from the Wikipedia page about official statements, because there's a few things here that I think contribute to the conversation we're having. it says, in April 2005, during a book sign, so I guess to give the whatever kind of context is, yes, it was the idea that there was a riddle. The published Enigma is a mystery involving a riddle proposed in connection with the 1994 Pink Floyd album, The Division Bell. It originated on the internet as a web-based contest, implemented presumably as a promotion for the album and its tour. It remains unclear whether or not the Enigma was a genuinely solvable puzzle, as certain details regarding the actual nature of the challenge have never been revealed. The consensus is that it was eventually abandoned by its creators, and the matter has not been brought to an official conclusion. Now, here's the official statements. In April 2005, during a book signing of his biographical work, Inside Out, A Personal History of Pink Floyd, Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason acknowledged that the published Enigma did exist, that it had been instigated by the record company rather than the band, and that the prize was to have been something on the lines of a crop of trees planted in a clear-cut area of forest or something to that effect, which also makes me think of Jim Jones.
Oh,
anyway, the quote here is, "That was a ploy done by EMI. They had a man working for them who adored puzzles. He was working for EMI and suggested that a puzzle be created that could be followed on the web. The prize was never given out. To this day, it remains unsolved." The comments made by Mason corroborate parts of the previous interview by Sean Heiser with Mark Brickman, the Floyd's lighting and production designer, and the man apparently responsible for putting the, quote, Enigma Publius message in the lights at the New Jersey concert. Quote, "I think it really came out of, though, it came out of some guy in Washington, D.C. that used to be with the CIA or FBI or something that was in the encryption game. He decided he wanted to do some kind of album cover, and he started talking to Steve O'Rourke. And I think that what happened was Steve O'Rourke had in his brilliant mind that he was going to try something on the internet because he had been listening to me. And he got this guy, because if you notice, a lot of the stuff can't be traced where it comes from. And I know that Dave, for one thing, didn't even know how to sign on." Brickman later brought the accuracy of his testimony into question when he denied having told the truth to Heiser and refused to take responsibility for a series of strange Usenet posts made in his name. All right, so that just brings into line here, we have two different things. One, the possibility of someone who works with the CIA or FBI playing with the Pink Floyd fan base, again, you know, like a MKUltra Manson connection playing with the Beatles fan base. But then we also have the idea that the band had nothing to do, you know, Nick Mason saying the band had nothing to do with it. It was a promotional campaign by the record label. And here I have to wonder, with some of the, you know, things that are found on Beatles record covers or these different things that we're able to find like this, part of me almost wonders if this EMI Pink Floyd scheme wasn't inspired by an earlier, you know, Apple Record or whomever scheme, to not necessarily thought up by the Beatles band members, but something done, again, you know, this is where you might tie into a, you know, record industry Illuminati sacrificial conspiracy, or just to say, some sort of weird promotional scheme to create a puzzle to get people talking.
Right.
I'm kind of throwing a bunch of things out here, but I'm just curious if where this takes your mind on this.
Well, I've come across, like, so you got, like, Hypnosis does all the Pink Floyd covers. When we look at those Pink Floyd covers, we're associating them with Pink Floyd all the way. If you see the cover of Dark Side of the Moon, which is, like, one of the most, like, resonant symbols, you know, like, associated with Pink Floyd, that's not supposed to be them. That's this other group who's doing their artwork for them. Yet, the resonance of the artwork with the album is so fucking uncanny and completely related. I wonder how true a lot of that is. Like,
I'm sorry. Yeah. I gotta throw in this other piece of the puzzle. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
There is also on this Wikipedia page in the media, and they're doing different things where this has been referenced. There's one that I think is really hugely fucking important to what we're talking about. Here we go. In the artwork for the mini-disc release of A Momentary Lapse of Reason, the word Publius has been inserted into the photo of the man in the rye field. The word Enigma appears in the lower corner of the picture of the man standing on the edge of the cliff. So, what is the catcher in the rye?
Yep.
I mean, that's fucking crazy.
Yep. Chapter 27.
Yeah. 27, exactly, 27.
Oh, man.
Sorry, so I know I kind of threw you an extra little curveball there, but as we're talking about all these things, the catcher in the rye connection is actually explicit.
I feel like I've come across so many times where there's an artist, and then it's like whatever is suspicious is being put on to the record company, and I wonder how true it often is. Like Lady Gaga didn't name herself Lady Gaga, you know, that was her producer who named her that because of Radio Gaga. But I just have to, you know, there's like this idea of like handlers. Does Pink Floyd have like handlers? Like, people refer to it this way when it comes to pop music, but when it comes to rock, they don't generally like approach it in the same way. And I wonder if they've just, if it's always been consistent and that we're just looking at it differently depending on who it is that we're relating to. You know, like people don't talk about Marilyn Manson's handlers, you know. Is it Pink Floyd's handlers that are working on some crazy occult lines and not the band itself? Seems like it's a way to write off the responsibility or something. Like, as if they weren't connected, you know? I mean, I don't know. Maybe not. I'm just putting things out there. I found that, you know, Pink Floyd is very much one with its art demonstration and what's being communicated. Like, are they just not talking to the people from, like, Hypnosis, for example? Like, those people just listen to the album and come up with their thing and Pink Floyd likes it? Or is there, like, what's the degree of communication between them and then, like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, are they completely compartmentalized? Because I have a hard time believing
right.
that.
Right, I have a hard time believing that, too. I mean, I think that, again, the story is that for Dark Side of the Moon, it was the band, or one of the band members, who requested that a very simple sort of symbol, you know, an easily recognizable symbol, minimalist style cover be created. You know, again, where does the actual truth lie? I don't know, but I would have a hard time. You know, I feel like obviously you have a record label; they're going to tell you, even as like an author, right? You're not designing your book cover. If you get a record deal, how much input do you have into your album cover versus, you know, again, as a writer, if you get a book contract, they're going to say, hey, this is the artwork we came up with. Now, I think maybe in more modern times, you could probably have a little bit more say if you're big enough or if they trust your artistic vision enough for your band. And then again, you probably reach a point. I almost view it as like a cycle. If you're too small, they're going to say, hey, this is the artwork we came up with, our marketing team came up with. Then you might get big enough where you can actually make those decisions for yourself and have more say. But then if you get really fucking big, I feel like that's where very often the record label comes back in and goes, all right, it's so big now that we got to control this shit to make sure it stays big. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
My wife's a really big fan of this band called Muse. And this is there's a kind of really interesting series of riddles for me within their music that I won't go into in great length. But you see as they get bigger and bigger, certain things happening, and then where they suddenly blew up and got really big of this one album. That's where you actually, in their most recent album, it's called The Second Law. You see, this is where the record labels came in and said, whoa, we have to control this fucking thing. I mean, what an insane shift. They had all the band members take voice lessons. It's very obvious. They had them take all these very specific voice lessons, and the whole sound of the thing changes. The message of the thing changes. And this is at the time where, for the album, in which they are the official song of 2012 Olympics. Now, this is how I knew when going into the 2012 Olympics, everyone was so like, oh my God, you know, it's the year 2012 and it's the Olympics and it's the Illuminati and they got giant eyes and pyramids as the lighting design and they're going to set off like a nuke or New World Order is going to take over or something. And I remember I did an interview like a few months before the 2012 Olympics and I was like, you guys realize this is the biggest psyop ever. They are fucking with you. Because the way I knew was because this band Muse, they have a song called MK Ultra. They are like, they sing about conspiracies. They've actually, the lead singer has been on Alex Jones's show.
Right.
Like, they were totally into the conspiracy stuff. And all their songs are about, like, you know, who are the people who rule this society and who really is the man behind the curtain. And it's all like all these different types of conspiracies. You know, they have a song about fucking Project Bluebeam. They have a song like that. There's all this sort of shit. They named one of their live albums Harp. You know, it's like, so like, I'm thinking they probably did this so that people would Google. I mean, if for nothing else, you name your fucking album Harp. And every time someone Googles Harp, you know, some teeny bopper is going to Google this, they're going to come across some real information. Could be the way that they were thinking. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think legitimate argument.
So now, this band suddenly gets signed to have the official song of the 2012 Olympics, which for me was the Conspiracy Olympics. It's the thing that, you know, Rick Clay had been talking about since, what, 2007, 2008, this Olympic ceremony was super important, you know, Illuminati ritual or all these different things. People have been telling me this for 5 fucking years about this being the ultimate conspiracy, you know, this was the conspiracy Super Bowl for, you know what I'm saying? This was the conspiracy holiday, was the 2012 Olympics. And then you sign on the most popular conspiratorial band to sing the official song of it. And I'm like, they're fucking with you. They are fucking with you.
Right.
Sorry.
But just because, fucking bombs go off or something just tragic doesn't happen in relationship to the event itself that's in, you know, in view of everybody, doesn't mean that it wasn't contributing to the great work on some level. In terms of like mass mind control, like that plays into something else. Like it's like it feels like it's just more conditioning or more programming that ends up playing out in various ways that are beyond our capacity to recognize the connections generally. I mean, that's a possibility. I'm always just stating possibilities.
Sure. That's why you and I understand each other.
But
because we're sort of like allowing our minds to just explore different.
At the same time, I feel so feel so bad about Subliminal Synchrosphere, because I can't even communicate to the guy how much I, like, actually appreciate his, like, this is what he feels, and so this is what he's stating, and he has every right to state it. And if he thinks that it's a fucking conspiracy, cool. You know, whatever. Think what you want to think. You know, say what you want to say. You know, and like, and I mean, I don't buy into a lot of the things that he says, as like a lot of it feels like stretches to me. But some of it, a lot of it, is just like so, like, even non-debatable when you start making the connections. And so, like, I don't know. I look at that and I just see more programming and more conditioning. And that's what that is, as far as I'm concerned, you know, for the most part. They're fucking with you, yes, and it doesn't mean that nothing's coming out of that.
Yes, sure, yeah, it definitely has an effect. It has an effect on your psyche, without a doubt.
On a mass level. Because everybody's fucking taking part in this thing. And the giant fucking baby, the moon child that they had set up, and all the, and with its head straight up, looks all like the cover of Imagine or Rosemary's Baby, you know? It's like, it just, I don't know, man. I feel like there's something going on. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, to me, I do see, I see it less of a, I see it more as like a statement of intent, in the sense that, yeah, they're showing you a phoenix rising from the ashes, they're showing you the baby, they're showing you, you know, they even did the thing of like a bus blowing up, you know, it's like, they're, all the different things that they're doing, to me, is a statement of intent that says, we intend to rule the fucking world.
Basically.
Right.
And that the New Jerusalem is in England.
I don't know that, again, you know, whether you want to say there's a magical cause and effect, that by them doing this quote-unquote ritual, it will allow them to rule the world, or any, you know, any of these sort of kind of trippier tangents to that, I, as far as where does the conspiracy stop and start, yes, where I totally 100% am behind is all this stuff is a statement of intent. We want to be the new fucking controllers, or we think of ourselves as the controllers of the world. The where that falls apart for me is the hubris in such a statement, and the conspiracy crowd's failure to realize that there's something bigger than those conspirators. So the guys who are running the United Nations, you know, and saying, hey, we're gonna, or European Union, who say, hey, we're gonna build a Tower of Babel. We're gonna design our thing like the Tower of Babel.
Yeah, straight up.
We're gonna do that. Is that the hubris of like, hey, we're so big we can do this now? Or is it the intellect that says, of course this thing is going to fucking fall, and we'll be there to catch, you know, to when that power vacuum happens, we'll be there to catch it.
Right.
Again, you know, all the different ways you could read into that.
Well, they're backing up far enough to get an overall perspective. I mean, that's the feeling I get about the temple in the first place. I mean, that's the meaning of the temple, is because they know it's going to fall, because they're told by Hashem that the temple will fall, but they build it anyway. Because why not? We're here. We might as well do it, right? And, like, that's the meaning of that. It's a continual fall. You know, as soon as they leave the garden, it's just a perpetual collapse. And so, like, that's why Exodus repeats Genesis. The story of Genesis is the story of Exodus. And that the thing just keeps repeating, and that they keep tumbling further and further away. And, I mean, that's the Kabbalistic take on the thing. And so the Tower of Babel is just another example of a continuation of the fall from grace, or the fall from the tree of life, which we become further and further removed from. And that's just something that, you know, they look at it, and in their overall viewpoint of the development of the world, all they care about is the end result. And different people have different takes on what that end result will look like, because it's up to the person's temperament and their own conditioning, or their own relationship to the material, to determine that for themselves. And then we have now, due to the internet, kind of this kind of like general consensus view of the diabolical side of it. And I don't think that that's all it is. Like, I have a hard time accepting that all these people are looking at it through this, like, the way that we're approaching, like, the Lucifer lens. And I guess this is the difference I have with subliminal synchrospheres, because I don't make a sweeping generalization that all these people are on the same page. But I think a number of them are. But at the same time, I think that there's people out there that want to reunite the tree. They're still looking at it through they have a view of the ultimate reconcilement, you know, and there's people that recognize that if you have a means and an end, the means has to look like the end. And there's people who just ignore that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's like...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, going back to the John Lennon thing, you know, recently I watched The Haunting of Julia, a.k.a. Full Circle, with Double Fantasy, starting it at Mia Farrow's opening credit. And I'll put that up soon, as soon as I can. But holy shit, that blew me away. And the implications are huge. But what I gathered from it is that they're basically playing with their idea of witchcraft. Yoko Ono and John Lennon. It's a very witchy film in the first place, and it's a very fucking witchy album, you know. And they're just like, they're beyond dabbling in the stuff. They're playing with these symbols. And then I see, like, they've just gone so far with it that it ends up, the line between dream and reality just wears thinner and thinner, because they're operating on so many levels at the same time that it actually ends up manifesting as a reality in a way that they themselves may not have even have necessarily been aware of, although they may have been. They just still weren't prepared for it, you know, because it's heavy.
It's very heavy. Yeah, so, and I agree with you. I mean, and what I think, where I sort of part ways with a lot of the conspiracy stuff is the religious sort of, you know, it's inspired by religious fundamentalism. You know, the idea that, oh, there's something witchy or magical, to me does not automatically equal evil in any stretch of the imagination, at least for myself. You know, somebody doing something witchy is not necessarily bad. There's plenty of, you know, modern pagan witches, or people who think of them as such, that I would have no problem with, and I don't think are part of any sort of, you know, evil agenda. It's only someone who comes from a sort of religious background that would automatically make that jump to conclusion. However, if we just sort of putting that little caveat out there that I don't think it's evil, yeah, they definitely played with this concept through and through, and you have to wonder at what point it sort of overtook them, perhaps. The fact that you mentioned Rosemary's Baby, you have, right, all of them witches. So they're saying this is a coven of witches. Now, are you familiar with the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus?
Oh, sounds familiar. What's on that?
All right, so Rolling Stones, they wanted to do a TV special for British television, and they got a bunch of bands to perform at this thing. But it was supposed to be a televised event, so they have all these people, and they're all dressed in costumes, and they had this circus theme. So, you know, Mick Jagger is dressed as the ringleader. Speaking of Full Circle, he's the ringleader of this circus. And they have, you know, like The Who plays there, and Jethro Tull and Taj Mahal. And I mean, it's if you listen to it, like, you know, if you listen to the album that they made of it, it's incredible music. If you watch it, it's pretty fucking cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the video, it's like, I can't, you know, you said Patrick Svek watched Magical Mystery Tour 25 times. Mm-hmm. I cannot watch Magical Mystery Tour one time. Like, I think it's pretty unwatchable for me. Anyway, the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, it was supposed to be televised. Mick Jagger actually fought to have it not aired because you know, the story is that the Rolling Stones spent so much time putting the event together that they didn't rehearse enough, and the Who had just been doing this like 2-year live tour, and they were totally, you know, in well rehearsed, well tuned stage. So the Who comes on, does an amazing, incredible performance, and then the Rolling Stones are the quote unquote headliners. They're the last ones, and they're kind of off, you know, and they're like, oh my God, we should have prepared more for our musical set and less for putting the event together. We're kind of embarrassed by this. Let's not air it.
Uh-huh. So, it reminds me of the Star Wars Christmas special.
Right. Now, as someone, I actually, and again, I have immense sympathy for that. I mean, it's the same mistake I've made over and over and over in my own life is, years ago, I put together like a comic book anthology for these people, and I spent so much time putting the own thing together that I realized, oh shit, I never did my own chapter for it, and I had to rush through production of it. For a Sync Book Volume 1, I kind of did the same thing. I spent so much time proofreading everyone else's chapter to make sure they looked good, I missed a major typo in my own fucking chapter. You know, it's like all the different... So anyway, I'm just saying, like, I get it. Trust me, Mick Jagger, I get it, actually. But, so here's the whole point of mentioning this, is that it's John Lennon comes in and performs at this thing, and he does this really interesting thing with Mick Jagger that I think you'd get a kick out of. So there, and as many times as I listened to the album, I only have seen the video once or twice, and when I watch the video, it sort of really changes the whole thing that I'm watching, but because they're sitting there like eating a bowl of spaghetti. And it's when you just listen to it, it sounds like John Lennon is high as all get out. And Mick Jagger's talking to him, like trying to introduce him that he's going to play. And John Lennon just sounds like so fucking out of it. He's like, hey, John, thanks for coming here and playing tonight. And John's like, yeah, well, you know, it's not my fault we don't talk anymore. And... you know, and Mick Jagger's like, no, I'm happy to have you here. And John's like, yeah, well, you know, like, I don't know, the whole thing is like, he sounds spacey and kind of antagonistic, and it's really funny to listen to. Anyway, the thing that you don't realize till you actually watch it, John Lennon is dressed as a wizard. He's wearing like the classical pointy hat with stars and moons and a wizard's robe. And Yoko Ono is dressed in a black shawl and black pointy hat. She's dressed as a witch.
Yeah.
Like, what does a wizard and a witch have to do with a circus costume? I'm not exactly sure. But that's how they dress for this thing. So when we talk about the meeting, the sort of interplay between the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and again, like, I think we've talked about this. It's so the connection. Are you a Stones man or a Beatles man, right? Well... in the Egyptian imagery, it's a beetle that pushes the rolling dung ball, right? Like the beetle that pushes the rolling stone.
Yeah.
Like they are so interconnected. The imagery of those two on a symbolic archetypal level is so fucking connected. You have the movie that was made, that Peter Frampton Bee Gees weird ass Sergeant Pepper movie. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Where then they have like, you know, it's actually Aerosmith comes in to be the evil Rolling Stones fighting the good Beatles, Sergeant Peppers. Again, like it's something they've played with over and over and over again of this whole idea. It's hard for me to not see that. This was something the record industry decided to use as a dichotomy, as a Coke versus Pepsi. But on an artistic level, I have no doubt these motherfuckers respected each other, maybe competed with each other, and probably inspired each other and played off each other. And maybe in the background, hey, you're into this weird occult shit, so am I. You know, let's see if we can kind of team up here and... let's play. If the record company is setting us up to be, you know, Jochen and Boaz, why don't you play up your pillar and I'll play up mine?
Yeah, it's pretty priceless in the Magical Mystery Tour when you play Her Majesty's Satanic Request over it, because the let's sing this song together. You know what I'm talking about? That song. Why don't we sing this all together?
Yeah, yeah.
The way that it's the beginning of the album.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes,
and
absolutely.
The way that when it starts over, they play it goes through again, and so it's like the ending of it. It like ties it all back together. Whereas that's also there's a reprise at the end of the album in the first place with that. It just really drives it home that that's what they were trying to communicate. Like I honestly feel that they came out with that in response to that film, to be played over that film, and that is the earliest example that I've come across of what I consider like what is most likely an intentional album movie sync is on the part of the Rolling Stones, which I didn't really expect, and I don't feel that they did it with the Beatles awareness, you know, like I mean they may have, but it seems almost more like a gesture of like they're actually communicating, why don't we sing this all together? It's pretty trippy.
The Beatles, All Together Now?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and this is the same thing where you see like that, if you watch Yellow Submarine, I mean, here's something they didn't even contribute their own voices to, but then they come in at the end and go like, hey, yeah, that was a pretty cool movie. All right. You have to remember at the time that this was happening, you know, there's Beatles bobbleheads and lunchboxes and, you know, there's a whole marketing enterprise around all this stuff that they're sort of throwing their name on. But without a doubt, they are aware of some, like, whether they are or someone else is, there was a Beatles, kind of like a Saturday morning cartoon thing, which has them, like, falling through pyramid stargates and weird shit. You know, it's like,
I saw that.
So, you know, like there is without a doubt people behind the scenes going like, oh, this is something special. Like this is an opportunity to really try something. And again, whether you're trying a giant magical ritual, I am open to that. Again, not necessarily quote unquote evil, but even if it's not evil, it doesn't necessarily mean it's quote-unquote good either. You know, it's like, hey, we can play with something, but do you know what you're playing with?
Winston, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's really nice to have you, John. As you know, I've admired your work for so long and haven't been able to get together with you so much as
I want. It's not been my fault, Michael.
Do you remember that old place off Broadway?
Those are the days I want to hold your man. Remember that.
John, I want to talk to you about your new group, the Dirty Mac, which you got together for tonight's show.
Well,
comprised of yourself.
Myself, that's Winston Legthigh, you know. And we've got Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh, you really?
Yeah,
experienced.
Really. Oh, very, very. You've read my file. And we've got Eric Clapton from The Cream, the late great Cream. Michael, the
fantastic.
Late great. And we've got Keith Richard, your own soul brother.
Dirty.
Great. I'd like just to give you this, Mike. On
thank you, John.
The British public.
You're a blues, John. You're
same
a blues,
you,
John.
Michael.
You're blues, John.
One, two, three, four. I'm lonely. Yes, I'm lonely. Wanna die. If I ain't dead already, girl, you know the reason why.
was of the earth, but I am of the universe, and you know what it's worth. Just like Dylan's missing guns. I'm lonely, wanna die. If I ain't dead already, girl, you know the reason. Black cloud crossed my mind, blue mist round my soul. Feel so suicidal, even hate my rock and roll.